Okay, it's great to be here. I want to first thank the organizers for putting this program together. Thank you for the invitation. So today, as George mentioned, I'm going to be talking about a perovskite iridate. So we'll switch gears from edge to corner sharing in this talk. And I'll talk about the use of nonlinear optical response as a method of probing some interesting ordered phases in these systems. So let me, I guess I don't need to motivate much. Phil thankfully did a great job motivating iridate. So let me say a few words. One of the reasons why, in general, we're interested in these kinds of compounds is for the following reason. When you have systems with strong electron-electron interactions, they give rise to interesting phases like mod insulators, high-TC superconductors, et cetera. And if you take materials with strong spin-orbit coupling, we've known over the past decade, they give rise to phases like topological insulators and a slew of new topological materials that have even more recently been discovered. Okay? So there's a big sort of unfilled quadrant of this phase diagram where spin-orbit coupling and strong electron correlations both interact simultaneously. And there are some interesting phases that have been proposed that are nicely documented in this review, one of which is what's called the spin-orbit coupled mod insulator. Okay, so I'll be talking about the spin-orbit coupled mod insulator today. In fact, strontium-2 iridium-04 is a prototypical spin-orbit coupled mod insulator. I'll give a short introduction about this compound. And since nonlinear optical harmonic generation is, at least in its capacity to tell you something about correlated systems, might be unfamiliar to some of you, I'll spend some time introducing this technique, both its principles of operation as well as some sort of advances in instrumentation that we've developed in our lab to enable these measurements. And then lastly, I'll show you some results where we use nonlinear optics to look at both interesting crystallographic distortions in this compound as well as some what we call hidden magnetic order in this system. Okay. So the reason we focus on iridium oxides, as most of you know, is because as you go down the periodic table, U starts to decrease, this electron-electron correlation strength, whilst the nuclei get bigger, and so the spin-orbit coupling strength and also the crystalline electric field energies get larger. And at this 5D row, you start to balance these things out so that you have this interesting interplay between all three types of interaction. And the spin-orbit coupling, I should mention, in this 5D row is pretty large. Okay? It's on the order of half an EV, and so it's very non-negligible. Now, naively, you might think that as your wave function gets bigger, the orbital overlap between adjacent sites gets larger, and so just like in many 4D transition metal oxides, you get metallic behavior. So it was counterintuitive when it was first discovered that strontium-2 iridium-04 actually is a mod insulator. And the explanation is very simple. So here's a picture of iridium in this octahedral coordinated oxygen cage. The iridium ion in 214 system is in this 4+ state with 5 electrons in the D shell. When you put it inside this cage, it splits the D bands or D states into T2G and EG states. The effect of spin-orbit coupling then splits the T2Gs into effective angular momentum 3/2 and 1/2 states. In this case, the 3/2 are completely filled, whereas the 1/2 is half filled. And owing to the sort of the spin-orbit narrowing of the J effect over equals a half state, these systems are very susceptible to small amounts of U being able to open charge gaps. Okay, so that's sort of the pictorial representation for why these systems, even though there's large wave function overlap between sites, can still achieve mod insulating behavior. Okay, and this idea was pioneered in this paper right here. Okay. So the reason that we were in the field, in fact, and we're particularly interested in the single-layer perovskite 214 system really comes from its similarities to cuprates. In fact, it's structurally highly analogous to the parent compound of the high-TC cuprate lanthanum-2-copper-04. Okay, so let me spend a slide just going through, just reminding you about what lanthanum cuprate looks like. So it's, as I mentioned, a single-layer perovskite made up of stacked square lattices. Okay, so you have these copper atoms sitting at the vertices of squares, Each copper atom is coordinated in an octahedral cage that are corner shared, okay, and these are stacked in an alternating fashion like so. So strontium iridate is extremely similar. You just take the lanthanum cuprate structure and you give a twist in plane to each of these oxygen octahedra, one set in one direction, the other set in the opposite direction, giving rise to a doubling of the unit cell. Okay? And so here's sort of, again, a planar view of each layer stacked as shown. Okay, so not only are these systems crystallographically similar, they're also magnetically very similar. So in lanthanum cuprate, there's at some temperature close to room temperature, you get an ordering of the spin half moments that form this antiferromagnetic pattern, like so. And in strontium iridate, something very similar happens. Below about 230 Kelvin, you get an ordering of these spin orbital entangled moments, which we call J effective equals 1/2 moments. And they look, the ordering pattern is very much analogous to lanthanum cuprate, with the exception that the moments, at least experimentally it's been shown, that the moments sort of cant by an angle very similar to the canting of the octahedral cages. Okay, so let me say a few words about this magnetic structure in particular. First of all, there's no net magnetization. Okay, so in every layer, there's a net ferromagnetic moment pointing in plane. Okay, so you can see that all the J effective moments are canted in the same direction, so there's a net moment pointing down in the bottom layer. But that net moment alternates from layer to layer, and so in one unit cell, there's no net magnetic moment. Okay. I should also say that this magnetic structure has been characterized carefully by both neutron diffraction and resonant X-ray diffraction, and it's found to realize a centrosymmetric magnetic structure. Okay, so it's a magnetic structure that has a center of inversion, and the proposed magnetic point group is this NNN1' point group. Okay, so let me say a few things about electronic structure. So these are LDA plus spin orbit calculations. So in the case where you neglect Coulomb interactions, you can see that these J effective 3/2 and 1/2 manifolds give rise to these big Fermi surfaces. They get folded across these zone boundaries due to the doubling of the unit cell coming from the octahedral rotations. Okay, and as soon as you introduce some Coulomb interaction, you get a splitting in that J effective equals 1/2 manifold, giving rise to this mod insulating state. Okay, so that's sort of the basic picture. Okay, so beyond crystallographic and magnetic symmetries to cuprates, very recently some interesting things have been found using angle resolved photoemission spectroscopy. The first work came out in 2014 by B.J. Kim's group, where they show that if you dose the surfaces of these crystals with potassium, thus affecting electron doping, then, beyond some critical temperature, they find that these large Fermi surfaces begin to show a gapping of spectral weight near these antinodal regions, okay? So here, this this sort of half monolayer picture is probably the most clear, where you see sort of a segment of a Fermi surface, but suppressed weight at these antinodal regions. So this looks sort of eerily reminiscent of the pseudo gap in cuprates. Okay? And in fact, if you measure, you can use photoemission to measure the gap at each point in momentum space. And if you look at how the gap evolves as a function of departure and angle away from this nodal line, this 45 degree line, then you can see that the gap, it's gapless, along the 45 degree, and then it starts to rise up all the way up to almost 80 millivolts, considerable. As you get to the antinodal region. So this, again, is very similar to what happens in cuprates. So this is surface doped. And more recently, there's been evidence of...
So the strontium and cuprate, the unit cell has one copper atom.
Right.
But iridium has two.
Yeah.
Because the structure is different.
Right.
And in the end, the Brian zone...
Is folded. That's right.
Do you think it will affect the interpretation of...
So certainly, I think, recent... Let me say a few words with regard to this slide. So if you look at this compound, this is also bulk... It's lanthanum doped. It's affecting bulk electron doping. So it should be doing something similar to the potassium surface doping. In this case, what these authors find is that if they use, there's some matrix element effects in ARPES that perhaps cause this backfolded band to maybe be more suppressed in this data, but it's there. But nevertheless, even though you know the sperm surface probably look more like lenses, in this case they find something similar. They find a pseudo gap-like behavior if they measure the gap evolution across this lens. So here's again the evolution of this gap. You know, near this 45-degree line, it's close to zero, and then it picks up to a value close to what was observed in the surface dope case. Okay. And similarly, the pseudo gap has also been reported on the whole dope side. So rather than substitute strontium with lanthanum, if you substitute iridium with rhodium, that turns out empirically to affect whole doping. And rather than the Fermi arc being along the, you know, pi-pi direction, in this case they find that the Fermi arc is along the pi-zero direction. Okay, so, you know, this brings us to the question, in cuprates, the pseudo-gap is well known, and there's some, you know, a plethora of interesting broken symmetry phases that underlie the pseudo-gap, okay? Ranging from charge-ordered states, pneumatic order, loop current orders proposed, etc. And, you know, a similar idea can then be extended to the iridates, which is that, you know, we know that as you dope the antiferromagnetic non-insulating parent compound, you see pseudo-gap behavior. Okay? The T-star line, the phase boundary that bounds the pseudo-gap phase is not well experimentally determined in the iridates yet, but there's probably some boundary, and there have been predictions of all sorts of superconductivity that might take place in strontium iridate. And recently at low temperatures, these two groups have even given evidence of D-wave sort of node as you cool the system further down. And so the question that we want to address is, okay, are there other interesting broken symmetry phases that might underlie the pseudo-gap phase of the iridate that so far haven't been found? So to this point, you know, people know that there's an antiferromagnetic ordering near the parent, but nothing else so far has been discovered.
Try to figure out a difference between these class matrices and the cuprates.
Yeah, sure.
So is there any, like the difference?
The difference
from the data point of view. Right?
From the well, I think you know, the iridate is
very exciting. All new.
It's not superconducting.
Well, the question is, you might go down to lower temperature, you might expect, that's the predictions, right? You already
that's right.
expect Einstein's theories, in the sense I already kind of anticipate, right?
Yeah.
You guys are very smart, quick down, go down to lower temperature. So do you see D-wave and also like a dome shape? Or so what would you say is the difference?
Maybe you get a dome.
I think it's not even, we're not even close. Well, first of all, I mean, they've only seen sort of a D-wave-like gap spectroscopically, but they don't. Well, there's no transport data showing that it's superconducting, so that's unclear. So in my mind, we're very far from, you know, establishing whether or not there's a dome here. Mm-hmm. So it's probably a little bit premature to say what really are the differences before the whole phase diagram's been mapped. But I'll focus today on similarities. Uh-huh. So the rest of my talk will focus on whether or not there are interesting broken symmetry phases that might underlie the pseudo-gap phase in strontium iridate. Okay, so let me now delve into a little spiel about nonlinear optics and why we do this, why we go to the trouble of doing so. So you heard this, you know, just before me, the power of using diffraction as a method of resolving crystallographic and magnetic structures of material. There's an alternative way to do it, based on what's called Neumann's principle. So the idea behind this is that if you measure any tensor property of a system, that tensor property has to be invariant under all symmetry operations of the crystal, right? So if the crystal has fourfold rotation, the response has to respect that fourfold rotation, for example. And so the idea is that if you can measure this response tensor to very high precision, then it gives you some way of backing out what the symmetries of the crystal are. Okay, so that's sort of the idea behind what we're doing. The reason we want to go to nonlinear response is the following. If you look at just the linear response of the material, and you say, okay, what is the structure of this tensor given some crystal class? And I've chosen three as an example. That tensor structure actually looks the same, for example, for tetragonal, trigonal, hexagonal crystal classes. Now, as soon as you introduce more indices into your generalized tensor property, you begin to be able to distinguish between different, not only different crystal classes, but also different point groups within a crystal class. And generally, the more indices you add, the higher symmetry resolution you can achieve. And so that's the reason why, we have to go to the nonlinear channel. Okay, so the tensor property I've already alluded to that we're going to measure is optical nonlinearity. Even though, in principle, this could work for any nonlinear response of any, or the nonlinear susceptibility of any response. Okay, so let me say a few things about nonlinear optics. So this is the source terms for Maxwell's equation, which can be expanded with a dipole contribution, magnetic dipole, electroquadrupole, and so on and so on. And each of these induced multipoles actually is induced through the application of some external field. Okay, so in linear response, you can affect polarization in your sample by applying an electric field, for example. In nonlinear response, you just add another field to it. So conventionally, these are the responses that condensed matter community looks at a lot. Less so these ones, and even higher order. So today, we're going to just focus ourselves on second order responses, and these are responses where you're inducing a polarization, magnetization, or a quadrupole density, etc., through the absorption of two fields, all right, or through the interaction of the material with two fields. So in principle, or actually experimentally, the way it works is as follows. You take your sample, you blast it with some beam of light at frequency omega, and in linear response, you measure, let's say, the intensity of light reflected at that same frequency. Okay? And the susceptibility tensor that parameterizes this process is the linear electric dipole tensor. Okay? So you shine some electric field, you induce some polarization, you plug that into the source equation for Maxwell's source term I showed on the previous slide, and you can calculate the radiated power. So in the second order response, it's slightly different. By virtue of absorbing two fields, you can actually emit a photon at twice the frequency of the incident photon. That's something called second harmonic generation. And high-order processes, like the electric quadrupole process, magnetic dipole, etc., can be expanded in terms that look like this. So the one thing that's interesting about second harmonic generation, and the reason why I want to focus on this today, is because second harmonic generation turns out to be very sensitive to the presence of inversion symmetry. Okay? So in fact, if the system has a center of inversion anywhere, it doesn't have to be on a crystallographic site or an atomic site. If the system has a center of inversion, then this electric dipole contribution to second harmonic generation has to vanish, okay, by symmetry. And this is typically much, much larger than any of these other higher multiple contributions. On the other hand, the electric quadrupole tensor, which is just four indices, these don't have to vanish, even if your system has a center of inversion. And so this term will always be there. So as a prelude to the results, I'll say that, second harmonic generation is very sensitive to the presence of broken inversion, because if you break inversion, you suddenly have an electric dipole contribution that can kick in. Okay. In addition to being sensitive to inversion symmetry, we also can gain sensitivity to spatial symmetries by performing what's called the rotational anisotropy experiment. So in these experiments, you take a cleaved crystal surface, you shine in a beam of light at frequency omega, measure the desired harmonic you want. In our case, we're looking at 2 omega. And you measure the intensity, for example, of 2 omega beam as a function of this angle phi, which is the angle through which the scattering plane rotates about the surface normal. Okay. And if you, sort of intuitively, you can already see that if there's some interesting mirror or rotational symmetries, you'll catch that in this kind of measurement. Okay. And we can select the incoming and outgoing polarizations to either in or out of the scattering plane, which is basically a method to sort of be sensitive to different tensor elements in our response tensor. Okay. So let me just give you sort of a brief idea of how these experiments are actually carried out and why they're rather difficult. First of all, if you remember Philip's talk, these crystals are typically really small, sub-millimeter. And you're trying to shine a beam of light at low temperatures to a good, of that crystal, you isolate some good optically flat spot, and you want to isolate a beam on that spot and rotate your scattering plane without walking your beam. Okay. You want to make sure that the normal to the crystal lies in the scattering plane throughout your 360-degree rotation. You want to avoid any precession of the reflected light, in other words. And so due to these challenges, especially if you want to do it cryogenically or at high magnetic fields, these experiments are much easier done on large, flat, single crystals. So there's a lot of work on thin films and polished single crystals, but very little on the types of systems that you're interested in. And as I already mentioned, if you want to put these things in an extreme environment, it makes the challenge even greater. Okay, so the idea we came up with, which in principle sounds really straightforward, is just to rotate the scattering plane instead of rotating the sample. It sounds very, very silly, but in fact there's some mechanical kung fu that goes on behind it. So let me tell you a little bit about how this is done. Okay, so first of all, the light source that we use is a pulse system. The reason we use pulse systems is because the conversion efficiency into the second harmonic, especially if you're going to look at these higher multiple contributions, are exceedingly small. In fact, in our case, it's about 10 to the 12 photons in, 1 photon out. Okay, so we got to really take advantage of the high electric fields that are producible through these pulse systems. That's the only reason we use them. Okay, so we take this what was called a regenerative amplifier that produces some pulse strain at 1.5 eV center energy. We put that through an optical parametric amplifier that then sort of allows you to shift the wavelength. That goes through a polarizer, some sort of polarization rotation optics. And the key element here is this, what's called a PM. This is a phase mask. And one way to think about it is it's a diffraction grating in transmission. Okay, so you get a beam that comes in, that focuses on your phase mask, that splits the beam into two. We block one order. We take, let's say the plus one order. We shine that into an objective lens. In our case, we use a reflective objective in order to minimize dispersion. That's how we gain our oblique incidence onto our sample. The reflected light that consists of all the harmonics you want get reflected out in the diametrically opposite side. It traces out a diametrically opposite path. We pick off that beam with what's called a decut mirror, analyze the polarization with some polarizers, spectrally filter to isolate the desired harmonic, and then photon count in a photomultiplier tube or some electron multiplying CCD camera. Okay, so yes.
So this measurement is like specifically for surface.
No, it's not. So this I'll show you in a second. This is actually bulk sensitive.
Bulk sensitive.
Yeah. Okay. But it's a very good question because SHG conventionally is a very good tool to look at surfaces. So why are we sensitive to bulk? So I'll just tell you in a few slides. Okay. So the way we affect the rotation of the scattering plane is by putting certain of these key optics on manual rotation stages. So our setup looks like this big contraption on an optical table that's got these mechanical rotation stages that are rotating our entire setup. Okay. While the cryostat remains stationary. Okay. So if we do things in this way, then you can start to think about doing things on small crystals at very, very low temperature environments, and as I said, putting on any fields you want. Okay. Let me say a few things about the characterization of our instrument. First of all, our beam size is focused down to about 20 microns, typically on the tens of micron scale. The way we align our instrument is that we actually unblock this order, and we let both beams come through and interfere in our sample. Okay, so this is a picture of the optical interference pattern of the two lasers on your sample. And first of all, if you find some marker in your sample, like a local defect. You can look at how this beam spot changes in relation to the location of that defect as you do this 360 rotation, and you can quantify how much beam walk you're introducing this way. We can stabilize our system to about a micron. And the other thing is, the other nice thing about using this interference effect is that the wave vector of these interference fringes tells you a little bit about how much you're processing. Okay, so how much the angle of incidence is changing as you're going through this 360. Okay. And so here I'm taking the spatial Fourier transform of the patterns along the different angles of my scattering plane, and you can see that, you know, the magnitude of that wave vector is very much constant, even as I go through this full 360. So that's the way to both sort of align our instrument, but also to, you know, give us confidence that, you know, these effects that we're seeing are not coming from misalignment. So the number that we can bound our precession to is about 0.05 degrees, which is very good. Okay, so let me first, let me start by introducing how our probe can be used as to measure structure, okay? And strontium-214 happens to be a very good system to begin because even though space group has long been held to belong to this tetragonal I41/ACD symmetry group, very recently, both Feng Ye and Steve Wilson's group here have taken higher resolution neutron diffraction patterns of these samples, and they found, you know, forbidden nuclear Bragg peaks in their diffraction pattern that can be indexed by this space group. Okay. So there have been a few proposed ideas for what might be going on. Maybe it's a global structural lowering that just wasn't captured by previous diffraction measurements, making the crystal lower symmetry than I41ACD. Maybe it's some, you know, spatial inhomogeneity or structural defects giving rise to it. And so these are the types of questions that our technique is very good at addressing. Okay, so here I'm showing you an example of what our data looks like, and this will get to your question about why it's bulk. Okay. So first of all, I told you that the signals are exceedingly low. We tune our frequency to a resonance between the oxygen 2p and the unoccupied T2g levels, which is about 1.5 eV, conveniently. And here are four different SHG rotational anisotropy data sets taken with four different polarization geometries. Remember, we could tune our polarization either S or P, so you have four different geometries labeled by these two indices. Okay, and the way we do refinement is the following. So these were three of the symmetry groups that were proposed to explain the forbidden Bragg peaks that people saw in neutron diffraction. So you can take these symmetry groups, you can reduce your tensor, your susceptibility tensor, under each of these groups, and then try to fit the form of those tensors to your data. Okay, so let me start with the non-centrosymmetric candidate groups first. So as I mentioned earlier, as soon as your system breaks inversion, you're going to be dominated by the bulk electric dipole contribution. So if you calculate what the symmetry of the bulk electric dipole pattern is going to look like for these different groups, you find these color-coded according to these three different groups. And hopefully by eye, if you stare at it for a second, you can see that actually none of these fit the data. Most dramatically, if you look at, you know, this this SS pattern, you can see that the D2 and D4 space groups don't even give any signal in this channel at all, whereas we see clearly something there. Okay, so let's talk about whether, you know, the well-known I41ACD would work. Okay. Well, the bulk is centrosymmetric, so let's ignore that first. But, you know, as you mentioned, SHG is really good at looking at surfaces. So maybe it's surface electric dipole contribution giving rise to it. Okay. The surface breaks inversion inherently, so that has to always give you an electric dipole contribution. What they look like is overlaid on the data up here. Okay, so in these two geometries, the surface electric dipole contribution can't give any signal here, in contradicting to our experiments. Here they have to give you something isotropic, which is again nothing like what we see. Okay. Okay, so maybe it's the bulky electric quadrupole then. Okay, so let's calculate what that looks like for I for one ACD. Well, as it turns out, they also don't fit the data very well. Okay? And there's two things that you should point your eye to. One of which is in these, you know, S out geometries, the patterns have 8 equal petals if they were coming from bulk EQ of this group. And the peaks should be aligned along the crystal graphic axes. Whereas in fact, our patterns clearly, A, are showing not 8 equal petals in these geometries, but big and small, big and small. And the patterns are also rotated away from, the peaks in the data are rotated away from the A and B axes, telling you that, you know, some mirror symmetry is already broken. Okay, so it turns out that the bulk electric quadrupole radiation coming from a lower symmetry group, I41/A, actually fits the data exceedingly well. Okay, so that's the overlay fit. So I'll spend maybe let me say one thing. So remember, you know, there were speculations that maybe it's some spatial inhomogeneity that's taking place. We can also run our experiments in scanning mode to see if that might be so. This is a linear optical image of the crystal, just to show you the locations where we can scan. Here are a few select points we scanned over. And what we found is that, you know, the symmetry is uniform throughout the crystal. This is not something arising. The lowering of symmetry is not something that's isolated to a few different regions. Okay. So here are some implications of what this means. Okay. So first of all, when you lower your symmetry from I41 ACD to I41A, effectively you lose what are called the C and D glide planes. So you sort of lose two mirror planes, which we could already see in the data itself. And one way, physically or microscopically, you can lose it is if the tetragonal distortion on these two different sublattices are different. So the tetragonal distortion is basically the splitting between these different D levels if your octahedra is not perfect. It's either stretched or compressed a little bit. Okay, so what this means microscopically is that, you know, on one sublattice, let's say sublattice 2, the octahedra is a little bit stretched. On octahedra 1, it's a little bit more compressed. That's a mechanism of generating these loss of glide planes. Okay. And there's some interesting implications to what this might mean. So, you know, building on the model of Jekyll and Kalulin. So in their case, in their model, they assume that the tetragonal distortion is equal on both sublattices. And they, through their work, they can actually calculate how much the angle of this J effective moment is canted away, okay, with respect to how much the octahedra is canted away from its undistorted position. So in red, or excuse me, in this color bar, what I'm plotting is the ratio of the canting of the moment over the canting of the octahedra. So if it's 1, then that means the moment perfectly follows the angle by which the octahedra is rotated. Okay, so in George's model, if you give him the spin orbit coupling strength and the size of the tetragonal splitting, then this model can deduce a phase diagram that looks like this, where the ratio of these angles sort of depends on how much depends on how large delta and lambda are. Okay. Now, experimentally, it's been shown that this ratio is actually very, very close to 1. This is from both neutrons and X-rays. So one thing that relaxing this assumption enables you to do, for example, if you were to put a staggered tetragonal splitting on the two sublattices I mentioned earlier, then your system becomes then this ratio of 1 becomes very robust against changes in lambda and delta. Okay. So this so-called magnetoelastic locking might be more robust and might be so robust in experiments for the reason that the two tetragonal splittings are different on the different sites. Okay.
May I ask a question?
Yeah.
So if I take lambda equals 0, then I don't have any rotation of the spins.
Yeah.
That's so how wide
down here?
On the right side, it's always 1, independently of the value of the lambda.
It's always 1.
I mean, on the right side of the phase diagram.
Mm-hmm.
So this red color means that the firewall alpha is about 1, independently of the variables lambda.
The lambda doesn't start from 0, right? I mean, in the left.
Yeah, I don't know what happens when you turn it off. It shouldn't really follow if you turn it off. You need some spin orbit coupling to make them talk. Okay, so now let me talk about temperature dependence of these patterns. Okay, so this is room temperature, and remember, just from a few slides ago, I'm picking just two different polarization geometries, one cross-polarized, one parallel-polarized for illustration purposes. Okay, so these patterns, remember, come from this bulk electric quadrupole contribution, owing to the fact that the crystallographic symmetry is centrosymmetric. It has inversion symmetry, again, by virtue of, you know, what the pattern looks like, we know that. And it has C4 rotational symmetry. Okay, it's a tetragonal crystal. Okay, now as we cool it down, so here's data at 170, you see that something pretty dramatic happens. Okay. Let me do that again. Okay, so first of all, remember I told you that at least in diffraction, no other orders other than the antiferromagnetic structure have been observed. And that antiferromagnetic structure is centrosymmetric. So even sort of intuitively, it shouldn't give rise to such a dramatic change in your pattern. Okay? And in fact, you can actually perform magnetic point group symmetry refinement using our technique. Okay? So what we do is we took all the magnetic subgroups of 4/M, which is the point group symmetry that we deduced. We coherently added a contribution of that magnetic symmetry to our crystallographic contribution. And we go through all these magnetic subgroups to find which ones fit our data. Okay? And it turns out that there are only two that fit our data. One is 2'/M and one is M1'. Both of these subgroups break inversion symmetry. And both of them reduce the rotational symmetry from 4-fold to 1-fold, to none at all. And I guess, you know, qualitatively, you can believe the fact that it breaks inversion symmetry just by looking at how much of a change is affected. Okay? Remember, I told you that once this is, you know, we're sitting on a very, very small quadrupole background at high temperatures. Once you break inversion, you're going to see big changes happening to your patterns. Okay, so the magnetic structure is, the antiferromagnetic structure is centrosymmetric. It has 2-fold rotational symmetry. This is not it. So what's going on? Okay. Well, one, I won't commit to any microscopic model, but I'll tell you what. Okay, go ahead.
This temperature, the onset temperature for this this thing, is not the magnetic temperature.
Yeah. So we've actually done a very careful doping dependence study. I'll show you that in the next few slides. It'll come up. Just a second. So I can give you one microscopic model that actually produces all this, the required symmetries that we see. And that's this loop current order that's been proposed in the pseudo-gap phase of the cuprates. Okay? So in this loop current order phase, well, what happens is here's one iridium oxygen or copper oxygen plaquette. You have these little electrical current loops counter-circulating on opposite opposite corners of your plaquette, giving you no net magnetization in unit cell, but a little magnetic quadrupole moment. This order, of course, breaks inversion symmetry as we measure, as well as time reversal symmetry. Okay. And this kind of order naturally gives rise to 4 degenerate configurations with the loop currents running along either of 2 opposite diagonals and with the sign of the moments flipped either plus or minus. And so this kind of order conventionally is very hard to measure. One of the reasons is because it doesn't break translational symmetry. And in fact, in diffraction data, they don't see the appearance of any new peaks other than those that arise from the antiferromagnetic order. There's no net magnetization per unit cell, so you don't see a big ferromagnetic moment. It's non-dipolar. There's no net dipole moment per unit cell. And perhaps very, very importantly for experiments, if 4 degenerate domains are expected to be populated, then if you perform a spatial average, you're going to wash out this symmetry. Okay. So the way we overcome it, which I sort of glossed over a few slides ago, is actually we first have to do imaging. Okay, so here is a second harmonic generation image. Let me go back just a slide to show you what we're doing. You can look at these patterns. You can pick out the angle where something big is happening. Okay, so let's in the image I'm going to show you, that's happening at around this angle. Okay, and if you cool it down, you see the formation of these domains come up. Okay, and what we can then do upon having one of this, an image to use as a roadmap, is we can focus our beam down and perform local rotational anisotropy measurements to look at the point group symmetry in each domain. Okay, so we did an exhaustive, scan over all domains on several samples, and we always only find four domains, and these four domains look like the following. This is one I showed you earlier. The four different copies are simply four 90-degree rotated versions of this. And they're consistent with, what you might expect from a loop current, a phase with loop current symmetry.
Okay. Question?
Yeah.
In principle, there are also four magnetic domains.
Right.
Do you see them?
No. So we're actually insensitive to the magnetic order because it's centrosymmetric. Okay. And I'll have even more evidence I'll show you in just a few slides. Okay. So the next thing we do to answer your question is what's the onset temperature of this stuff? Okay, so not only did we look at the parent, but we also looked at the whole doped version. You can grow pretty big, surfaces with optical quality surfaces of these kinds of crystals. So in the undoped parent, remember I mentioned at about 230 Kelvin, you see the onset of long-range anti-ferric magnetic order. The nail temperature gets monotonically suppressed as you start introducing more rhodium. At 7%, it goes down to about 170. Goes down to between 50 and 100 as you go to 11, and then so forth and so forth. Okay. What you'll notice in the 7 and 11% crystals is sort of two features. One of which is you see this little uprise happening at about 170, followed by a kink, right, happening close to 100 Kelvin, and you see something similar here. The resonant X-ray diffraction figured out what was going on. Okay, so they found that first upturn is actually coming from short-range magnetic order. And the second kink you see in susceptibility is actually where the Bragg peak really narrows and grows up. So that's what they call long-range magnetic order. So Young-Jun Kim's group has sort of exhausted the phase diagram of strontium, iridium, rhodium 04. And they see the following. They see, again, like I said, the nail transition is monotonically suppressed with rhodium doping. And then, as you go away from the parent, you get a separation between short-range order and long-range ordering temperature scales. Okay. So what does our data look like? Well, if you just measure the linear response, the fundamental, as a function of temperature, there's no changes, at least within our noise levels. Okay. Going to the nonlinear response, you see, in our experience, a very dramatic upturn happening right very, very close to the nail transition in the parent. Okay. Now, as you start to dope away from the parent, you add more rhodium, what happens is that splitting between the nail temperature and that, what we call T omega, the ordering temperature of this weird phase we see, starts getting bigger and bigger. So by the time you get to 11%, for example, the upturn in SHG happens, 75 Kelvin above where both magnetic susceptibility and resonant X-rays first sees even the onset of short-range magnetic order. Okay, so in our mind, there's really this other phase that hugs the phase boundary of this nail order in strontium 214 that has the symmetries of this loop current order. Again, our probe can't give you the microscopic confirmation of that. We can tell you symmetries, though. In our mind, maybe there's some correlation between this temperature scale and the pseudo-gap temperature in the iridates, and that's yet to be confirmed by experiments. And one speculation maybe is that I think someone asked what the difference was. Is there superconductivity? Well, in cuprates, when you kill the pseudo gap, that's the peak of the dome. So maybe we have to look a little bit further out here. We have to go to the quantum critical point of this hidden order. And maybe that's where superconductivity will appear. I don't know. Okay, so let me...
It's just coincidence that it hits right at the nail temperature?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't understand that at all, why it's so close. If you perform a Landau theory for this type of order, then it only couples biquadratically to the nail order. So there's no reason that they should be so close a priori. Now, in cuprates, I think, they also see, for example, in polarized neutron diffraction, resonant ultrasound, some phase transition happening across T star. How the phase boundary traced by those techniques merges with the TN line there is not clear either. So whether or not this is something generic is unknown, but why they're so close, I don't know. But it certainly doesn't contradict anything I know.
Has anybody done the same experiment on cuprates?
Not to my knowledge, down at such low doping. Yeah. One of the problems with cuprates also is that the nail temperature can be extremely high in some of these cuprates. So I'm not sure. Not that I know of. Was there another question? Yeah.
So you were using Chayama's loop current picture.
Yeah.
So do you mean like this kind of all the break time rotor symmetry?
Well, it's a good question. So we see some symmetry breaking unambiguously.
Right.
There's no evidence for any crystallographic distortion. There's no evidence for any ferroelectric or anti-ferroelectric order from dielectric susceptibility measurements. The magnetic point group that we use fits it very well. So those are a piece of evidence we use to conclude that it's probably magnetically ordered. It's probably magnetic in origin. Can we directly probe time reversal breaking? No.
But is there some dynamic features? Like time reversal symmetry is eigensymmetry. So should have some dynamic property features in. I mean, it's the first transition, you can presume
yeah.
to see that.
So not that I've seen, but if you look at, if for example, you look at the cuprates and look at susceptibility data and try to look for the pseudo gap transition there, you also don't really see it. So, other than our results, I have not seen any other thermodynamic signature of this phase boundary by other measurements.
Is there been new as well?
There has been MuSR, in fact, and there's been right. Actually, I need to draw my memory. No, excuse me. I think it was an NMR measurement. Excuse me. That was done on the parent, and they see in the parent they see an onset of something happening close to the nail transition, and. They attribute their signal to some ordering of oxygen moments. So, again, if oxygen moments are ordering in a way that breaks the same symmetries as we observe, we can't rule that out either. Yeah.
Using your optical setup, could you look at Kerr angles to probe time reversal symmetry breaking?
We haven't tried. I think to really isolate the time reversal broken. Part of your optical rotation from regular birefringence. The Sanyak setup they have at Stanford is really, really good for doing that. That's an interferometric technique that we don't have the capability of doing. But it'd certainly be interesting for a Sanyak setup to look at this. Okay. Sorry.
You have this capability to measure the domains. Have you done the experiment where you heat it above TC, the onset temperature,
yeah.
T omega?
Yeah.
And cool it down and see if you return to the same domains?
No. The answer is no, but yes, we've done the experiments. So every thermal cycling we do totally changes the domain walls. So they're not, they don't seem to be pinned to any structural defect.
Can I make a live comment?
Yeah.
Question, why these two points at the same time? What if I think the magnetic order in itinerary picture, so I can regard the nail order as like S wave component, you know, this P wave component for the keen order, like this, like P wave spin density wave. You actually can break this C4 rotation down to identity. You know, that's what it does in mind.
Okay.
Maybe it's like the nail order is just the S component, the keen order is the P wave component, they always come together. But once you dope, they may have different strands. That means you can see different temperature. I mean, critic temperature. It's like there's a correlation between two.
Rate selection definitely C4, but also inversion.
I'm sorry?
Mm-hmm. At T omega, the inversion gets broken, not only C4.
Mm-hmm. No, suppose the heat one is like a P wave then best spin density wave. Like, I mean, talking about it, it's like you think about the particle pairing in the spin channel. But the heat wave is like more like P wave spin density wave. And your layer can be regarded like S wave components. It's basically you have S wave and P wave all higher order. You don't see the higher order, but you see the S and P. That's one of the things, probably one possibility. Does that sound like ridiculous?
I don't think I can rule that out right now, but I have to talk in more detail.
So you may not need the current, but you can just have a kind of spin, like a P-wave spin that you explain you out.
And then, so you showed very quickly the actual plots versus temperature of these things. And kind of the shape at x equals 0 is very similar to larger x.
Oh, the exponent
or something. Looks like an order grid.
It does look like one, but I will say, don't try to fit a curve to this, because this is we're seeing an interference of two different effects: bulk quadrupole and electric dipole, and there are interferometric ways you can isolate just, mm-hmm. you know, the hidden order part, but not here. So don't take the functional form too seriously as a reflection of the order parameter concept. And actually, while I'm on the slide, let me answer, I think is your question. You know, are we sensitive to the magnetic order? And the answer is no. And that's consistent with our understanding that the magnetic order is centrosymmetric. So it really should be a very, very small very, very small change to our, crystallographic electric quadrupole contribution. So it's reasonable we don't see it. Reasonable that we don't see it. Okay.
Do you see this hidden order in the electron dove case?
We haven't tried so far.
Tried.
Yeah. But we're actually running it very soon. But so far we don't know. Okay. So let me just conclude. Hopefully I've convinced you that, you know, nonlinear optical response is something valuable to look at, especially insofar as trying to look for hidden exotic phases. And it can be highly complementary to diffraction-based probes. It's very good at small crystals. It's got spatial resolution. It can look at these multipolar order parameters. We don't face strong neutron absorption cross-section issues. Crystallographically, it looks very much like, you know, strontium 214 has a loss of these C and D glide planes that lowers the symmetry with respect to what's been accepted. There's this hidden order we reveal, really existing over a pretty extensive part of the phase diagram, with a symmetry that's consistent with this so-called magneto-electric loop current phase. It's not trivially tied to the nail order, even though they are very close together at zero doping. And we're currently investigating its possible relation to pseudo-gap temperature and repeating similar experiments on the cuprates. I can't finish without telling you who actually did the work. So all of the hidden order, all the hidden order work, as well as a lot of the instrument setup, was the hard work of my postdoc, Dr. Lirian Zhao, which has been instrumental to making this a success. Dr. Trzynski, who is a former postdoc and is now a professor at Temple, was responsible for the initial buildup of this instrument and for all the work on the crystallographic symmetry lowering. And Hao Chu is a grad student who also worked heavily on this project. And I thank our theory collaborators, Natasha Perkins, Rebecca Flint, and Ron Lifshitz. And all the samples were provided by the Gangtao group at Kentucky. Okay, thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Thanks.
Questions? I have a question. So the since loop current order has some symmetry.
Yes.
So and the nail well order parameter and nail order has its own order parameter.
Yeah.
So if I start from the symmetry broken state, from paramagnetic phase, I have already broken symmetry, I went to this omega phase.
Yeah.
So, and then I go to the nail state. Do I still have to break some symmetry to get the nail order, or all symmetries are already broken?
So,
is it like a nail order, nail state is a kind of a subgroup?
Well, you have to at least break two. So the nail order has a point group 2/M1'. That's the nail order. And you have to lose the 2 because our system is our symmetry is C1. Okay. Now, okay.
So I have broken the inversion time reversal.
Already.
Already. So what do I break when I enter to the nail? Say again.
You don't have to.
So do I have another second order, second phase transition?
The nail order actually has 2, whereas the omega phase does not. So it's a phase that has twofold rotational symmetry. Okay.
But that's a higher symmetry. So I kind of restore the symmetry.
I'm sorry.
So is there, if you just take the symmetry of the loop current phase, is there any symmetry operation there which prohibits having a moment on the iridium site?
No, I don't think so. Let me say that both the nail phase and the loop current phase, they're both irreducible representations of the crystallographic group. So I think they can develop independently.
Well, they are, but if one is not part of the subgroup of the others, then I cannot have, a second order phase transition, or I don't have phase transition at all. Mm-hmm. If I have broken all the symmetries, and I don't break any when I enter the nail order from the loop current phase.
Yeah, so if. So in my mind they're independent, but if you think that the nail phase somehow evolves out of the loop current phase, then you'd have to gain 2. You'd have to gain this.
Yeah, that's the opposite question. I mean, he's asking you just take your loop current pattern, and now you draw magnetic moments on the iridium sites in the nail pattern.
That will
work. Does it change the symmetry at all?
Yes.
Can only lower it because you kept the loop current pattern.
No, it goes the opposite way.
No. So we don't allow you. We're not allowing you to erase the loop current.
Yes.
Then no. If you keep the loop current,
yeah,
and you put the anti ferromagnetic structure on top of it, then that's
so that normally means that in Landau theory, there would be a coupling, which is linear in the nail order parameter and to some power of the
So they're not right. So
that's not necessarily consistent with them being different UREPs. Means you might have a cube of the loop current order parameters.
Yeah, so I think it comes in as a bi-quadratic coupling. I don't think there's a linear coupling between them, between the loop current order parameter and the nail order
parameter. Again, it doesn't have to be linear in both, but if it's a, if imposing the nail order doesn't break any further symmetries, then there should be a term which is linear in it.
Let me look at our Landau theory again. It's in there, so I'm just forgetting at this moment.
Anyone doesn't have to think about Landau theory. Anyone can also just think about symmetry operations. I think most of us don't know magnetic point groups, magnetic space groups. We know non-magnetic space groups. Once you start doing magnetic space group language, we don't know what it means. Any theorists know what it means?
Maybe say a question again, maybe I'm not.
So, this magnetic space group is defined by some set of operations, which leave the structure invariant, including the magnetic elements. And then you ask, for example, if I take the iridium spins, how do they transform under those operations? If I draw the pattern of the nail order and I act with any of those operations, does it ever change?
If I act with any of the operator, any of the symmetry elements of the nail phase.
No, of the
loop current.
Whatever it is, Q phase.
Okay. Does it leave my magnetic structure invariant?
Yeah. If all of them leave the nail structure invariant, then it should be induced that means that whenever you have this Q order, you automatically have nail order at the same time.
Right. So okay. Okay, so now I see what you're saying. There are two different point groups. There are two different magnetic point groups that fit the symmetries of this hidden phase identically. One of them is 2'/m.
You don't know what it means.
For what it's worth. Okay, let me bring those up so that we, okay. So
it one of them very is very small. This is some very small group.
Right. This is very small.
Probably very few operations here.
Yeah.
You probably could actually tell us the generators, and then we could, George could go to it.
Well, it has twofold rotation about the c-axis, and then you do time reversal on that. That operation leaves it invariant.
Okay. Through what? Through the iridium site.
Oh, where?
It matters. Right?
Where am I rotating through? I think that in our, when we think
that's
about
actually a point group symbol, so it probably doesn't tell us.
You're saying where do I rotate through?
Just by analogy with the other symbol, I guess it's a point group symbol, so it probably doesn't tell us.
Yeah, this is
just somewhere.
Somewhere, yeah, I don't know. And this M, this M here is a mirror plane that's perpendicular to C. So I take my crystal and I reflect about this plane. Okay. So this is one magnetic point group that leaves this hidden order invariant, and this is another one. And we can't tell the difference between these two. But they both break inversion.
Actually, we only have partial information, right? It's not a space group. It's a point group, so we already don't know what's going on.
Now, the magnetic,
can you see? I'll write it again over here.
The magnetic point group of the nail phase is this. And so, are we not talking the same language? Okay.
Well, you just don't see.
Okay, so
it's the same on both sides.
It's the same on both sides.
It's not like two universes.
Yeah. I wrote the rotations on that side and the mirrors on this side. So if it is this one, for example, then any of these I apply to the nail order leave it invariant. But that's not true for this one, because 2 prime does not.
Prime means what?
Well, the prime means, two prime means rotate it by 180 degrees about C and apply the time reversal operation.
Oh,
The theories that you mentioned, the Gunlano theory?
Yeah, so Rebecca did the Landau theory for us. I'm probably misrepresenting her a little bit, but.
Natasha was involved, wasn't she coming?
Yeah. Natasha was doing the.
She'll be here tomorrow.
She was doing the crystallographic part, okay, not so this part.
Someone to blame.
Was she involved in this or in previous?
In the modification of your model.
How is the invariant and the toroidal order moments on the side?
Yeah, you can view these as toroidal moments. I mean, it's. But let me say, I mean, this. Okay, so. You know, our fit is model free, the way we analyze our data. I mean, we just take a general chi ijk, and then we look at all the magnetic groups and we reduce them.
It's a symmetry question.
So, you know, so this you can believe. You can believe our data is showing you one or the other. Well, how that's related to the nail. That's something.
So
here.
More questions? So can you think of anything like a spiral? You know, if I spiral the spins along the C direction, so each layer has a ferromagnetic moment, and I consider kind of a spiral of these ferromagnetic moments. Can I get some?
You would get a new Q in your
action. Yeah, but that Q, well, I mean, it's along the C, so it will be still pi in AB plane and some information along the C, and yeah, I mean, you can rule out from available experiments that there's a temperature range where this spins spiral instead of having collinear structure. Just, can such a spiral explain? Well, it breaks kind of inversion, but it's in a different way. So, not in plane.
I guess I'll answer in two parts. The second question is that as long as the system lacks any, you know, as long as the center inversion is absent anywhere in the crystal, we'll see what we see. You'll see a big second harmonic contribution. As far as your first question, it's a little hard to imagine. So what you're saying is somehow at high temperature it would develop a spiral magnetic phase.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
And then which is invisible to diffraction, and then at low temperature that turns into the spiral locks.
Yes.
And then the diffraction picks it up.
Yeah. You can imagine a theoretical model which gives this. If you have a competition between bilinear and biquadratic spin terms, effective spin terms, so then you can have this. so to say.
But it's statically ordered, or?
Yeah, it's statically ordered.
Static order.
I mean, it smoothly evolves from a spiral to a collinear state.
Yeah, so it's to me, it's maybe, I don't know if I'm understanding correctly, but it sounds hard to imagine that you can develop a static spiral ordered state at high temperature and have it missed by other probes. But if you forget what other folks see, as long as that spiral order falls into these point groups, then we can't rule it out.
I'm just curious, you know, why this loop current model was chosen. Is the only one which can fix the symmetry, or?
Why was it chosen? It's one of the phases produced proposed in the pseudogap of cuprates that we selected that has the same symmetries exactly as what we see. If there are others, again, if there are other models that fit these point groups, I'm agnostic to those. It's just really just for illustration purposes.
I seem to remember in the 214, in the early days, you know, there's no net ferromagnetic moment because of this stacking, but with a pretty small field, you can line them up.
Absolutely. That's a good question.
But does this experiment, can it be done in those kind of fields?
It can't.
Or does it feel?
In principle, it can. We don't have, our setup cannot do it, but in principle, it can. However, what I haven't said is that AF1 is a phase where it does what you said, left, right. Yeah. AF2 is a phase where it all lines up actually ferromagnetically. Yeah. And so a little bit, like you said, a little magnetic field or a little bit of rhodium, both act to lock every layer in the same direction. So these are, but again, we don't see any anomaly in our data across these temperatures. So I think we're insensitive to that. Plus, that retains centrosymmetry, so it's reasonable to assume we don't see it.
And if it does, the moments align, when do you call it antiferromagnetic?
It's antiferromagnetic in the plane, so it's like. Right?
It's called weak ferromagnet.
A weak ferromagnet, yeah. You can call it that.
Almost
What about the barium 214? Have you looked into that?
Yeah, it's a good question, and we've actually really been wanting to do that experiment, Professor Isobe in Japan actually, we've been working a little bit on his crystals, but they're just far too small for us to work with at the moment. So the short answer is no. I don't know. Yeah.
You mentioned in the beginning that there was some observation of a B-wave gap. In what regime does that go?
So that's a little bit harder to answer because first of all, that was done on surface doped crystals, and there was actually an ingenious way that they did it. They had to grow 214 on top of another more conducting compound. They quantified the doping level through fractions of a monolayer that potassium was put on. So
maybe it's a surface. Maybe it's a surface effect.
What they see is at the surface for sure. And that
ARPES is a surface effect in general.
Whether surface different from what would happen in the bulk if you did put carriers there.
Yeah, so the system is somewhat two-dimensional. first of all. All I can say is, you know, no one has reproduced that, you know, that D wave gap in bulk electron doped. So what one would really like to see is, you know, look at this compound and see if you can cool that down and see it. But these samples are pretty, you know, it's not that, and I don't know what'll happen, but these samples are pretty insulating. So those are really challenging experiments. Even seeing the surface case was, I think, a big achievement already.
I guess my colleague, Dong Lai Fong,
yeah,
he actually observed this kind of gap behavior with STM.
Yeah, that's
he's on
same here. Absolutely, yeah.
David will be staying here today and
tomorrow.
And tomorrow, and Philip, he schedules a meal with Friday, right?
No, also today and tomorrow.
Today and tomorrow.
Just for the support of the
So thanks, David, again, for coming. And shortly